My name is Matthew Wayne Selznick, and this is Sonitotum, episode 95. Hello, my friends. On this and every episode of Sonitotum, we talk about making stuff, mostly writing, finding success as we each define it for ourselves, and staying healthy and sane in the process. Who am I to be talking to you about such things? Well, I have been an independent creator my entire life, starting well, my life didn't start, but the independent creating started in the late 1980s, continuing to the present day. I was one of the first podcasters. I was one of the first independent publishers. I had the first novel in history with an initial simultaneous release in ebook, paperback, and podcast editions back when I spent as much time explaining what a podcast was as I did promoting the book. This episode of Sonitotum features a conversation, what I hope will be an evergreen conversation, chock full of value, with another author. Today we're talking to Anna Ziegelhoff. She writes horror and science fiction short philosophical stories with themes like identity, memory, and belonging. But there's usually a spark of hope and whimsy, even in her darker stories. She also writes long-form fiction and has some science fiction novels and novellas in the works. According to Anna, her short stories can be found in many different online and print publications like The Horror Library, Volume 8, Luna Station, Solar Punk Magazine, The Future Fire, Daily Science Fiction, the Flame Tree Press anthology Footsteps in the Dark, in several other horror anthologies, and on the Tales to Terrify and Flash Fiction podcasts. Anna is also an academic with a subject background in sociology and Jewish studies. She's a self-declared language nerd, so says her bio, and has been a language instructor, editor, translator, and most recently a linguist in the tech industry working on voice AI. She is currently on the editorial board of a magazine for academics who write fiction, AcademFic, the appropriately named AcademFic. She is, like me, a fellow Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Association member. She's also a member of the Horror Writers Association. Anna is originally from Germany, but she's lived abroad since 2008, first in England, and then since 2015 in the San Francisco Bay Area. When she isn't writing, she enjoys reading, traveling, encountering strange places, being in nature, looking at art, as well as singing in a chamber choir, which we'll hear a little bit about in the conversation to come. You can find her on Instagram as Anna with a Z, all one word, and I'll spell that out for you. That's A-N-N-A-W-I-T-H-A-Z. And of course, as you might expect, at annaziegelhoff.com. And that's A-N-N-A-Z-I-E-G-E-L-H-O-F.com. Enjoy the conversation to come, and I encourage you to stick around after the conversation. I've got big news about Sonitotum's future and other creative endeavors coming throughout the end of 2023 and into 2024. So stick around all the way to the end, but for now, here is my conversation with Anna Ziegelhoff. What do you create?
I write, most importantly. I am a writer. I write horror and science fiction. Sometimes that spreads out into other genres like weird or slipstream or whatever you want to call it. I mainly write and publish short and very short fiction. I'm also working on longer form, but I have yet to publish any of my novels or novellas. Recently, I worked on a literary translation project for the first time, which was really cool. I translated a couple of classic ghost stories from German for a publication. I'm also an editor. I am on the editorial board of a magazine called Academfic, like academic, but Academfic. And it's a journal for people in academia, so teachers and researchers in higher education who also enjoy writing fiction. I've been doing that since 2020. And then in kind of a completely different direction, I co-founded a classical choir about 6 months ago. And we just had our first concert, and it was really exhilarating to just work with really ambitious classical musicians in a very much DIY sort of setting. I think those are my creative pillars.
Fantastic. And there's a lot that I'm going to want to circle back around and dive deeper in. But I also love to follow up that first question with maybe an even more fundamental, but probably deeper one, which is, why do you create?
I don't know how not to create. It was always there. So I'm one of those people that will tell you that I started writing stories as soon as I learned how to write. And I think the big why is, like, it came all came out of a love for stories, and kind of having this dawning realization as a child that all my favorite stories were written by a person. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, I can do that too. That's awesome. And, you know, this completely childish or childlike mindset of, I can do this too. I'm going to do this too. With, you know, no internal censor, no internal critic. You just enjoy writing stories. And I just wanted to make stories I wanted to read. That's where that comes from.
That's, as you can imagine, that's not uncommon. But what I always find interesting to kind of excavate, and some folks have thought of this, some folks haven't. Sure, the love of story, the urge to create your own, absolutely, of course. Have you thought about what drove that originally? Because a lot of people will, you know, love stories. They'll love to consume, you know, narrative fiction in one form or medium or another. And that realization moment comes around, we realize, oh, other people ostensibly like me have created these things that I love. But what do you think drove that next step? Because not everybody takes that next step. What made you want to create your own stories? And I know you mentioned sort of that sense of play, but what do you think might be underneath all of that? If there's anything, you know.
It's such a great question, because originally I was 6 years old, right? Obviously, the circumstances were right. Like, I had always been read stories. My dad was a scholar and academic, and so there were books everywhere. So the setting was there, and I really don't know how. Oh, maybe an urge to entertain in a way as well. Like, I remember, like, writing my very first story and kind of saying, oh, I'm writing this for my little sister. Mm. So maybe that. But so this all, and later on, there was some, you know, shit going on in my childhood, or like growing up, it wasn't easy. So later on, it definitely became an escape for me and a coping strategy. Mm. But that wasn't then. The original thing where I really don't know. Mainly an urge to create. I really can't put my finger on it. This was way before it became a coping strategy or an escape. It's almost magical.
Well, I think, and I think having that environment, as you said, you know, your father was an academic, books all around. I think that helps a lot. I remember, and I've told the podcast audience this story before, but, I remember similarly, before it became a coping mechanism, and I'll get into that in a second, but one of my earliest memories is looking at the first bookcase that was, well, it's the first one I remember, and it was in my family and in my own homes for a long time thereafter until it finally fell apart. But but a very small little bookcase with children's books on it. And I remember hearing my mother's voice saying, books are like angels. Right? It makes you gasp, right? I talked to her about this, but, you know, in later years, and of course she doesn't remember it at all, right? It's one of those passing things. I think I recall that was part of, she was trying to get me to respect the actual tangible property. Like, you know, these aren't for scrawling in with crayon. These aren't for, you know, tearing the pages out. These aren't anything like that a very, very, very small child might be inclined to do. I don't even know if I was old enough to read yet. That's how old this memory is. But to me, probably not consciously, and probably, I mean, who knows? You know, it's stuck in my head, obviously, for my entire life. But I think right off the bat, there was this imbibing of, as you said, magic in the medium. And then many, 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 many years later, in an earlier incarnation of this podcast, I had a fellow podcaster interview me using the same sort of tentpole questions that were different at the time that I would use, you know, to interview others. And I wanted him to interview me so I would have something to give potential guests and show them, like, here's how this works. And the one question that I still use from that original version of the show is, why do you create? And so I had to answer it, right? I had to finally answer it for myself. And at this point, I was probably in my 40s. And giving it thought, I realized, because I had, you know, some more emotionally traumatic and sort of just a sense of underlying instability in my formative years, in my early teens.
I understand.
Yeah. Right. And I realized that creating was a way of instilling and applying some control to otherwise kind of, you know, creating a world where I at least understood the rules and could make them. So I understand that escape strategy thing pretty well. I don't know. What do you think? Does it all kind of blend together in your work now, or?
That is fascinating. So first of all, can I ask, what do you think your mother meant when she said angels, as in like a messenger or like a guardian, or just to make them sacred?
I think
it's fascinating to me.
I think just to make them sacred.
Yeah.
Because as I said, she doesn't remember saying it. It was something a parent says to a child. I think fundamentally, I think it's most basic. It was something a parent says to a child, so the child doesn't just destroy these things. Because I was raised Catholic, but it was an Irish Catholicism that was very steeped in pagan undercurrents, you know. I mean, my mother believed in the general Catholic stuff, but she also believed in fairies and you know, ghosts and psychic phenomenon and everything else. So there was that kind of, I mean, it's a long answer to the question, but I mean, the short answer is I'm not sure. I think that, again, that she was trying to just make sure that I had respect for them. But in my mind, it became, you know, these are something more than what they are, you know.
And
you know, memory's not a perfect recorder, right?
So
everything I'm telling you isn't completely influenced by another 40, 50 years of life more.
So to come back to your question, what is it like today? So I guess like in maybe three steps of creating. So the sort of magical beginning where I really don't know why, just the circumstances were right. Books and stories were valued. I was encouraged to create as a child. Then it became definitely escape mechanism all through my teenage years, really. And then it never went away. But while I was at university, I studied English and Jewish studies and focused very much on languages and stories and cultural history and things like that. It took a backseat in a way. I was always writing, but not as much as I was during my teenage years. And I always wondered why, like, I entered this English literature bachelor's program and all of a sudden I felt like I couldn't write or I didn't want to write anymore. Maybe because you spend all your time taking apart all these like big name authors, being super critical about it. And
people who work in candy stores don't like to eat candy anymore. Yeah.
Maybe that's what it was. And then it was never really gone, but it was not as prominent as it had been during my teenage years. Then I stayed in education and academia and entered a PhD program for reasons. And at that time, somebody came up to me and said, "Hey, you write, don't you?" And I was like, "Well, of course, I am writing a PhD thesis." And he's like, no, you write, right? And I was like, how do you know? And he's like, "I don't know, just something about you." And he invited me to join a writing group. And that was sort of when fiction writing became more prominent again in my life, because I hung out with these wonderful people once a month and we had tea and we shared writing in a very non-ambitious way. Yeah. And then I sort of, you know, kept doing it. I never really told anyone that I was writing, but it was always very precious. And I finally decided that this is something I enjoy so much. Why don't I try to actually succeed at it? And that meant, like, for the first time ever, you know, submitting a story to a publication. And I only started doing that back in 2018, and I was in my mid-30s by then. So I had this huge oeuvre lying around on like floppy disks or whatever. But I only ever started showing my fiction writing to people back in 2018. And by that time, actually, it had acquired a sort of, it's grown beyond escapism for sure. It still has magic, but it's also grown a little bit beyond the magic. And it definitely has acquired a more strategic and more craft focused approach these days.
I love that. I think you referred to the writing group and that interaction, that social interaction is precious. Because it that sounds like it was still play. You were still kind of unfettered.
Perhaps.
Yeah. And that's great. I think that you had so much time to incubate in a way. And correct me if I'm wrong or this is off base, but that allowed all of that academic craft focused and analytical and more critical in the classical sense skill to come to bear when you did decide to get serious.
It's become so writing for me these days is a really nice blend of a different ways of thinking. So there's, you know, as I said, like the craft aspect, the academic aspect, the thematic aspect, because most of my short stories have a very focused theme and it's often drawn from topics I've encountered when I was like studying sociology and Jewish studies. And it's very rich. So I'm really glad I have that subject background just to draw themes from and to be a little bit informed about the themes. And then just the plain like work of writing aspect, you know, because you have to sit down and write. And that's something that I definitely learned. I learned how to be productive and not wait for inspiration, but just, well, I guess I have to go to work today. So I'm going to do this. I'm going to write. It's my work. But then at the same time, fiction writing is not just kind of higher level thinking for me. It's also a way of thinking less rationally, because I do spend a lot of time thinking rationally. I'm very anxious person, and maybe we can talk about that more, the mental health aspect.
Sure.
So that was I've sort of recently identified like anxiety has been such a driving factor in my life. And I like to be very rational to counter that and plan everything. And, you know, it's also goes back to not having a very stable childhood. So I embrace being a control freak. And I spend a lot of time being very rational. But in writing, it's sort of a mix of kind of more of a dream logic, dreamscape, and irrational, and plus rational on top of it. So writing to me isn't kind of one additional mode of thinking between dream and rational in a way.
That's very interesting, especially considering, and perhaps this is why you classified your stuff as, in addition to science fiction, but horror, weird, slipstream. Mm. And tellingly to me, I wrote it down, whatever you want to call it. And there's that dream logic you mentioned, horror and weird fiction and slipstream.
Yes.
What they used to call. Yeah. I mean, weird fiction. I love hearing that come back because, and you know, you would probably know this better than I with your academic background, but the early and mid 70s weird fiction movement, the new fiction movement, people like Moorcock and Ellison kind of breaking away from the ray guns and spaceships, mm-hmm. science mm-hmm. fiction of their forefathers, you know, mostly yes. fathers. And I loved that stuff. You know, I loved the stuff that was not entirely classifiable and that had, well, a different logic.
Yes.
Especially some of I think of Michael Moorcock's, this guy who was writing these Elric books. But then you dip into the Jerry Cornelius books. Are you familiar with those?
No, I'm not.
Well, okay. So Elric, everybody knows Elric, you know, the albino yes. sword person, stealing souls with his sword, and he's deeply troubled and you know, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Well, that was just one aspect of this whole eternal champion thing that Moorcock had going on and still does. And another incarnation of this eternal champion idea was this bisexual swinging 60s, like Austin Powers mixed with James Bond. And I know Austin Powers is already sort of
James Bond.
Yeah. He's already mixed with James Bond, but with all this like countercultural, I would mm-hmm. not be surprised if Austin Powers was based on a cleaned up and made funny, less risky version of Jerry Cornelius. But you could not really, it was like a fever dream of an mm-hmm. episode of the Avengers, you know, the old mm-hmm. Avengers TV series. And so that's what I think of when I think of weird fiction and that sort of, again, that logic that serves the story more than anything that might be
yes.
linear.
Yes.
So how do you balance, and maybe this is a process question. We talked theme, you talked the dream logic, you talked about, you know, the structured more side of things. I think of storytelling, there's the architecture part and the craft part mm-hmm. and the theme part. What comes first? How do you reconcile? Tell me a little bit about that process. And if you'd like to use a specific work, you're welcome to. Mm.
That's such a tricky question because yep. every time I am in the kind of the search and I call it like I find the story. Mm-hmm. So I will sit my butt down every day and write, right? And sometimes I get really frustrated because there's nothing. Like I'll start something. I'm like, oh, I would like to write about a character in this situation. And I start, but it seems shallow to me and I scrap it. And those are not fun times when I'm just sort of like messing around. But mm-hmm. at some point there's the search, and I call it the search into story, where I'm like, this is where I want to go. And once I'm in the search and something is done or at a point where I can edit it, which is my favorite thing to do, editing, mm-hmm. like more than writing. But then I look back and I'm like, how did this happen? And I'm like, I don't know how this happened. And then I get scared of not being able to reproduce it. Mm. And that happens a lot. But so really super technically, what often helps me is I have, usually it's a theme or a setting or a conflict that I kind of want to explore. And I sometimes, like, I try to, you know, when you can't remember a name or something and you stop thinking about it for a minute and then it comes to you, that's sort of like that. So I know, like, here's an example. Recently, I've been really fascinated with the back rooms, this internet lore of, you know, you suddenly slip out of your reality and you end up in this infinite, abandoned office building. And there may not be creatures in there with you, but really you're alone and you're in this flickering neon, environment, and it's weird and scary. And I've been really, this world is really appealing to me, but I haven't been able to find a story inside it, but I've worked with it. So what I do then is like, okay, I want to write something that has the atmosphere of an abandoned office building. Okay. And then I'll try to like, look away from it for a minute and I focus on other things. I may read something, or watch something, or I spend a lot of time on DeviantArt, just like searching for random keywords and then just like looking at art and being inspired. Walking always helps. Nonfiction always helps. Like reading nonfiction helps me. So anyway, at some point then I suddenly find a character that fits into this environment. And then once I have a character, I sort of ask them questions like, how did you get there? What did you want? You know, what dreams did you have to abandon? And that's often how I find a story. So there's a theme or a setting. Then I look away from it for a minute and let it steep. And then I find a character. And once I find a character, that's the story.
And you said you ask them questions.
Yeah.
Is it a writing exercise or just kind of in your head?
It's usually writing. I kind of think with my fingers. So I do just type or I write long form as well. I just sort of think about it. And I ask, and I mean, not even like, I don't like say, hey, how did you get here? But I'm like, how did this character get here? Maybe they, and then I just sort of talk to myself and while I'm writing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I go back to my journal or whatever. And I usually have this little tag where I highlight passages in my journal. I'm like, oh, this was an idea that excited me that morning when I was journaling. And then sometimes I go back and look at it and then I draw it out and into the story. And then, yeah. So, and once I kind of have that more irrational thing solved, and then I go and I really apply the craft aspect and the technical aspect of it. Then I'm like, what's the theme? How do I characterize this? Like I pay attention to point of view and what can this character know? Things like that. You know, the more rational stuff comes in later.
That's interesting. I, and you know, this is far from something that I invented, but I found it useful and I started doing this. I don't do it every time, but when it's necessary, I will have. I mean, it's not automatic writing, but it's definitely method acting, I guess, because I will create on paper a situation where the conceit is that I'm sitting down, not as a character in this world, but as the author, talking to a character in that world, on paper, you know, at the moment, again, the conceit is that it's right before the book begins or the story begins, you know, and just, and it's a way to get into that character's voice. It's a way to practice writing that character's voice, which of course, for me at least, means, embodying that character, appearing, and it could be, it's not even, you know, like about, it doesn't even have to be about the story. It might just, you know, might start it off with just like, you know, so, you know, what were you doing yesterday? You know, and what do you think about this other person, this other character? And it's amazing what can kind of come out if, and here's that play aspect again, right? Because nobody ever needs to see this. It doesn't need to make sense. It, you know,
absolutely.
It doesn't have to have a logical sense that the, that the character knows they're talking to the author and yet, you know,
I've done that before as well. Sometimes like when you say method acting, sort of what I was reminded of, okay, sometimes when I, especially when I write longer pieces and spend more time with characters than when I write a short story, I, you know, I like to, like, for some reason they're like, oh, okay, what's an example? Like, I try to get into their heads. Mm-hmm. Like, if they're into pottery, then I may like notice, oh, I don't know anything about pottery. Let me take a class on that. You know, like the, how, like method acting, I have to know this because a character has to know this. And of course, it's part of research, but there's also an experiential aspect to it.
That's right.
Or like, for some reason, there's a lot of tea in my stories. Like, people always drink tea and my writing group mocks me a little bit. They're like, oh, there's your tea again. I'm like, yeah, I like writing cozy scenarios, or, you know, and tea is always such a easy trope or symbol to make something cozy. And, you know, we're having a conversation over tea. Anyway, so I was writing a lot of tea and I had to plan myself a little tea garden. Because it's like, oh, I want to have a tea garden too, because this character has a tea garden. So I planted like lemon balm and chamomile and mint and stuff to make my own tea.
Fantastic.
I mean, method acting wise, method writing, I guess.
It's method writing. Yes. Yes.
And
it's,
yeah, method writing.
And it's, I mean, it can be exhausting in the practice. I mean,
I'm sure
if you have, I mean, just in the course of writing the actual prose, you know, for me, it's like head hopping, you know, but I think that can be revelatory too. You know, you discover things, you know, about yourself even. But also, so it sounds like you start with, once you discover it, it sounds like you start with a thematic goal in mind. Like, this is going to be about this. And then the rest of the things have to fit into that.
Or premise, like, there's a story out in Luna Station, an issue from March. Mm-hmm. It's called Artist in Residence, and the premise was, I think I had been listening to a podcast about, you know, have you heard of Vanta Black? It's a paint that's pretty much doesn't reflect light.
Oh, right. So, the completely non-reflect. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I listened to this podcast about this Vanta Black and how artists crave that. They just wanted that color, that product, really, because it's like a Vanta Black TM, you know? So it's you can't just buy it. And artists just wanted to work with this so badly because it's nothing. It looks like nothing. And I was so fascinated with this, you know, the competitiveness of the artists all wanting to get on the nothing, you know, they wanted to have work with nothing. So the premise for the story was, well, why, or my question to that story was, why is that so appealing? And so I kind of wrote a story about a void in space. There's a void that doesn't do anything, you know, it doesn't have intention. It doesn't, there's nothing in it. And there's some Star Trek episodes that have definitely done this before. So it's not a new concept, but, so that was the premise. That was what was there first, the thought, like, why is nothing so appealing? And then I made it from there. And it's like this whole world where artists compete to get to spend time on a space station near the void to experience this nothingness, you know, and they get competitive about it. And then that's kind of, and then the story started rolling, you know, why do we even have to guard this void, and how do people exploit a void, you know, artists for their sakes, and then industrialists for their sakes and stuff like that. Yeah. So that's one specific example of how the premise was there. And then the story kind of grew around it.
Peering into the abyss becomes a commodity.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And then, like, whose commodity, and what do you want with it? And what do artists want? And what do, you know, industrialists want, and stuff like that.
And then you talked about both getting into the I'll call it the architecture part of it, and enjoying editing more than the writing. So do you, obviously you mentioned the point of view part of it, you know, choosing, discovering the appropriate point of view for that story. And that's something that applying those limitations or removing limitations, depending on the point of view, of course, is so important. And it's
such a grave decision. And, you know, at times I kind of experiment with particularly point of view for a good while before committing to something. And mm-hmm. and sometimes it's pretty clear from the start, because I need to limit a point of view, for example. Like, I don't want the character to have all the information right. about the world or something mm-hmm. like that. But often enough, I do experiment with who is the point of view character, if it's a, you know, a third person point of view, or is it a first person narrator even? That's something that I definitely spend a lot of time sort of, experimenting around with in that initial phase when I just type out words as fast as I can. Mm-hmm. Definitely part of it.
Yeah. I had been, arguably, I am still struggling with my next novel. And mm-hmm. one of the things that I came to realize, and it required understanding the character, the protagonist, deeper than I had, because I'd started writing it a few times in the same POV as the previous novel in what will be this trilogy, and that was, you know, sort of a over the shoulder third person, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. You know, hopping from viewpoint character every chapter or scene, as the case may be. I finally realized, and I'm both kind of exhilarated by this and challenged by it, it's gonna be an exercise in growth for sure. But I finally realized that, well, this character who is basically a scribe and kind of a arrogant genius, you know, he's the smartest person in the room all the time, even when he's not. he assumes that he is.
I sense a flaw.
Well, of course, yeah, right. And so I finally realized, well, no, this whole thing should be essentially epistolary, but through his journals, his records that he is keeping. And it kind of turned the key, like, okay, now I know how this is at least supposed to work. Now I know how I know what my architectural problems are now. You know, that this, go ahead.
And now you got to do it. Oh, wow.
Well, of course. Right. Yeah. And that's the quote that I keep coming back to again and again is from Orson Welles, who said that an absence of limitation is the enemy of art. Oh. Right?
Yeah. It's so, I absolutely, so you know what? I love writing extremely short fiction, like micro and flash, just because it really allows me to experiment with that, with the restrictions. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. Then when I go to do larger projects and I commit to perspective, or, you know, what you were talking about, then I feel like, oh, I've had so much time on my playground in short fiction and flash fiction that maybe my choice will be more informed when I write longer fiction. Mm-hmm. So like, I love, in flash fiction, it's so much fun to, put this constraint on yourself by, for example, this is an encyclopedia entry, even though, you know, lots of flash fiction publications have in their submission guidelines assess, please do not send us encyclopedia entries. It's apparently so many people think of that. But like, I have a story that I'm really proud of that I love writing. It's in Shoreline of Infinity, a Scottish science fiction magazine a few years back. It's a flash fiction and it's written as advertising copy. So it's somebody wrote advertising copy, but then, you know how you, when you collaborate on a document, you get all these comments, right? And then replies to the comments by somebody else. So it's the copy, but then a junior marketing professional adding her comments on the copy, and then a senior marketing professional adding her comments contra the junior marketing professional.
Conflict.
And in the middle of that, this underpaid freelance copywriter who's absolutely cynical and has to write this advertisement copy for a completely pointless product. That was so much fun to write because of the constraints, you know, like this is, you have advertising copy and then two marketers chatting in comments using their, you know, professional business bullshitty language.
Right.
It was so much fun. And I love doing that.
All of that. Yes.
Yes.
And
yeah,
you make me automatically think of the probably apocryphal Hemingway advertising copy / fiction. You know where I'm headed, right?
Go on. I think I do.
For sale, baby shoes.
Oh,
never worn.
The baby. Oh, it's heartbreaking. Yes, I don't. Yes, I thought that's the one. Yes,
it's almost.
It's amazing.
Zen Cohen. It's hardly even flash fiction, right?
It's incredible. It's not even flash. It's just like, yeah, it's almost as poetry. It's so haunting, and to like, I love the even. Oh, talking about constraints, like if you have a word limit, if you're like 500 words or under, 1,000 words or under, you really start minding your words and trying to find, you know, whatever carries most atmosphere, carries most meaning, you know, it's a great exercise. So I think it really, writing short fiction really goes, it's instructive for writing longer fiction, I think.
And as you're getting into the longer fiction, I know you mentioned you're working on novellas and novels and whatnot. How much attention are you paying to, you know, the speaking of constraints, but also kind of speaking of tropes, the sort of standard Western 3 or 4 or 5 act, however you want to chop it up, structure and things like that. Do you, this is a roundabout way of saying, is your process more discovery writing once you've got your character and theme and things in mind?
Yes.
Definitely yes.
Yes. Yes. Let me stop you right there. Yes. I would always, like, if you had asked me this like a couple of years ago, I would have been I am a pantser. I am a discovery writer. I never plot. It's not quite like that anymore. I'm plotting a little bit, especially as I'm becoming more aware of the themes I really want to get across. And I put more rational thought into how do I get the theme across. So I'm becoming more of a planter these days.
Yeah.
Generally I used to be like, I just write a story. And then at the end, when I've written the story, I'm like, oh, actually, it does have a beginning, middle, and an end. So I didn't plan for it to be there, but, you know, because that's what I grew up reading and that's what I consume everywhere, the structure sort of is there. And I don't try to break it intentionally. Like I'm not like, I am going to be rebellious and write something that doesn't have a structure. I don't do that either. So I just kind of like, yeah, I guess the structure sort of dictated itself here. And
well, so often too in cross genre or difficult to define fiction, the structure that through line may not have anything to do with the plot. You know, it may not. There's always that, you know, when I ask, especially younger writers, tell me what this is about. And they start to describe to me what happens in the story. But no, tell me what this is about.
I guess it's more theme then, right?
But also I see over and over again, and this is mostly, you know, when lay people take in it doesn't happen as often in books, I think, perhaps. But when folks take in maybe a movie or the long arc of a TV series, and in the end of it, they're like, what did I even just watch? What did nothing really, nothing happened there. And I'm like, no, you just, it all happened. Did you miss it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not only the, like you say, the beginning, middle and end, the arc, it happens because mm-hmm. you are, well, you're trained both from being a reader, but also just critically understanding how story works, you know?
Yes.
And that's an advantage, I think. You know,
I think so. And I mean, I started writing less only for myself or mm-hmm. the five people in my writing group, but a little bit more with an eye toward, publication and, you know, entertaining people or, you know, getting a message across, even if it's just one person, or getting a sense of comfort across or something. Mm-hmm. Ever since I've been a little bit more aware of structure and the things that help sell a story, because, you know, you can be super experimental, but who's going to buy that? Or, sure. you know, who's going to sit with you through it? And I'm really happy that my writing group, I have kind of a mix of plotters and pantsers, and the plotters always sort of reel me in a little bit, and they will ask me questions. Like, I show them a draft and they'll be like, so, or they'll read it in terms of things like, so where's your hook? I think you should have a hook on page one, because otherwise a reader may not even continue reading this. And I'm like, but I don't want to. I want it to be a slow burn. I want it to be a slow reveal. And like, sometimes I'll always consider it when someone says, listen, this is boring. You can't have a slow burn reveal in a short story and then reveal something on page 10. You have to keep the reader wanting to read, you know? So I'm like, okay, I guess I'll put in a hook.
But doesn't this also come down to, though, who do you want your readers to be? You know,
absolutely.
David Simon, the creator of The Wire, and this is another quote that I keep coming back to again and again. His shorthand on this topic was, and by the way, you can swear on this podcast if you'd like to. Good to have the option. His shorthand for this topic was "fuck the average reader." Fuck the average reader and fuck exposition. And what he meant was, I mean, it's so multi-layered, but the first thing was, I took it to mean, don't assume they're stupid.
Oh, of course not. Yeah.
Don't assume that they need a hook, that they need, that they're gonna be bored, you know?
This is so cool. Yeah. There's a TED talk by JJ Abrams where he talks about that. He talks about trusting the audience and that I just realized, like, you know, when I'm watching something or when I'm reading something and I feel trusted as a reader or watcher, I am immediately on board. This is, good point.
Well, and also maybe the hook isn't an action. Maybe the hook is beautiful writing. Maybe the hook is a compelling premise. You know, I mean, ideally, you hit all three.
Sure.
You know, and that ideally, right? And nobody gets to decide that except the reader. But so does a lot of this. You mentioned that editing is your favorite part. Is a lot of this
kind of
in the editing where you're kind of the emerging properties of the work start to come out and then you're able to nudge them along? Is that?
I love that you're talking about emergent properties, because that's sort of what it is. Like, I write this messy zero draft, I guess. Mm-hmm. And by the end of it, I will know what the theme is. And then what I do a lot is I write myself, you know, the one sentence pitch thing just for myself. I write one sentence in which I try to summarize, this is what the story wants to do. This is what the story is about. Mm-hmm. And then I go back and start editing, and that's usually my favorite part, where I go back to the messy zero draft and I sort of take away everything that doesn't feed into that premise or the theme. And then, you know, I go over it many, many, many times, of course, but, and then usually always with a different perspective. So then I'll go over it and be like, okay, well, character, does the point of view fit? Also the tense, am I using a narrative past or am I using a present tense? Mm-hmm. And, how does everything feed back to my theme and my premise that I have specified for myself in the one line pitch? And that's all part of the editing. Yeah.
And so how, because my, the joke sort of is that, plotters and pantsers are the same because it's just a matter of whether you're front loading or back loading that, uh-huh, that work, you know.
And I'm back loading the work. Yes, I am back loading the work. I need some material to start from, and then I'll put it all in there.
I think I tend to be a front loader. And because I will do like, I'll do those crazy, long, but why writing sessions, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, figuring mm-hmm out characters and motivations and whatnot and backstory and the interview mm-hmm thing that I mentioned. And like my last novel was broken down to the beat level, you know, mm-hmm, and so when I sat down to write manuscript pages, it was just a matter of, right, okay, I know exactly what I need to do. And I could, and yeah, that would be where I would focus on craft. You know, the draft zero, yeah, was the the ridiculous, I think it was something like 30,000 words of, you know, just bullshit. It's just discovery. You
know? I love that. And what I love doing in the bullshit phase is as well, like not so much like you mentioned, like having me talking to a character, but two characters talking to each other.
Oh, sure.
It's like having pages and pages of coffee or tea in my case. I love that. I mean, what are you guys going to tell each other? Like, how did you end up on the spaceship? You know, why do you want to go in this like rescue mission into deep space? That's kind of the premise of a novel I wrote. Things like that. So much fun. Everything about this is so much fun.
Right. Yeah. I mean, my favorite discovery in that process, was in kind of free writing backstories for these characters. Mm-hmm. I was discovering world building elements. You know,
interesting. Yeah.
About the culture and things about the where they live and all that implies.
Do you write all that down? Like, do you have like a wiki where with all the world building? Wow. Okay.
Well, I'm gradually building a wiki, but this would have been in like, okay, well, this character, you know, I know that this character is Rajan, a woman in my last novel. Mm-hmm. I knew that she was very independent and rather oppositional and very strong-willed. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want all that stuff to just be in a vacuum, you know, not just, oh, here is a strong female character, sure, with capital S, capital F, capital C. You know? So I had to think about, well, what makes not even a woman, what makes a person into that kind of, mm-hmm, outwardly strong, inwardly damaged, mm-hmm, kind of person. And that led to, all of a sudden I discover that, she was part of this fishing community and her mother had an affair with a rival fisherman of her father. And, ooh, and they, the mother and the lover, had a boating accident and drowned. And she was raised by her father, who was angry at her all the, mm-hmm, time because she resembled the mother too much. And, mm-hmm, maybe it wasn't a boating accident and so on and so forth.
And then you have like four more novels.
Well, exactly. I'm off and running. But you know, okay, well, where is this fishing community?
Sure.
How is it in, what are the social and this is a fantasy story. So I was creating this culture from the ground up, and I did not want it to be your basic patriarchal medieval thing, you know? But the beautiful thing about this, and I don't know, you might, it all depends on how we all approach the larger body of our work. But I love to think in terms of story worlds and personal franchises, right? So yes,
Yeah. So I got that. Like I sort of have this experience. I wrote a short story once that was set on a spaceship, and it was a young woman who ended up on the spaceship because she's the captain's daughter, and her mother had just died, and there was nowhere else for her to go. So the dad took her on this rescue thing, this rescue mission, and I submitted that sometimes, and one time it got rejected with the comment, "This is beautiful, but it should be longer. There should be a novel." And I was like, "Don't mind if I do." Yeah. And I wrote the novel, and making it into novel, I had to ask more questions than I would have, or answer more questions than I would have if I had left it as a short story. So for example, why are they traveling for a long time into deep space? What are they doing there? And all of a sudden this whole political situation emerged, and then an environmental situation emerged, like what is life back on Earth? And then, you know, I was writing a whole spaceship crew from different areas of on Earth. How did they end up on the spaceship? What are their motivations and stuff like that? And all of a sudden it also went from being focused on this young woman, and it went from being almost young adult genre into this big politically precarious near future, where all of a sudden it really wasn't young adult anymore. And it morphed and morphed so much. So there's like, I wrote two novels in that universe, or that world. One is kind of YA, and the other one is like really sort of straight up political soft science fiction. And it's interesting when that happens. And sometimes like writing short stories, sometimes I come across a world in a short story where I'm like, this actually should be bigger. Like this premise in this world is big enough to make it into a franchise or into a novel or even a series. And it's fascinating how that can grow from like a one line premise into a whole world.
Absolutely. I mean, every time you answer why, you're given a new, you're given a new branch, you know, that you can cultivate. When I encounter writers who like, they just work in series, they just work in series, series of novels. And, you know, I've completed this series. Like, okay, but well, what about all the short stories and the poems and songs and plays and that could come out of that work, you know? And you don't have to write it all yourself.
Yes, you could. I mean, two things. Like I recently reread or picked up again, Always Coming Home, Ursula Le Guin, which is like, you know, it's almost unreadable because of that. But it's like an encyclopedia of a world.
It is.
And, you know, the other thing where I recently, because I'm watching the Silo series, after having read the books back when they came out, the Silo books, and that world is large enough to have spawned a lot of, if you want to call it derivative work, but people other than Hugh Howey have worked in that world. And that's fascinating too. So you have this whole collaborative, effort of, you know, working in this world that's big and open enough for lots of people to work in.
Yeah, it's great that you mentioned Always Coming Home, because I constantly refer back to that. I was gifted they did a slipcase edition with the hardcover book. You have this, or are you familiar with it? Yeah, the book and the cassette with all the songs.
Oh, I've never heard the songs, but there's music. There's like printed music in the
absolutely
book.
Well, you can actually find, somebody finally digitized the songs that were on the cassette of this slipcase edition. So you can find it, I think, on SoundCloud or something like that.
Oh, I'm sure. But
yeah, I mean, the complete experience, you know, and it's lovely. I know that we could continue talking just story for the entire time, but I want us to get to some of the other aspects.
Sure.
So let's awkwardly and violently segue into the other tent pole of the show, which is which is finding success as you define it. So what, how do you, as a creator, how do you define success for yourself? And where do you think you are on that? Allowing for the fact that, of course, it's going to change.
Yes. Yes. I do. Yeah. Thanks for that. how do I think, because I, you know, I've written all my life, never showed it to anyone. For me, success is really mostly not stopping, and making, being successful at making space for this kind of work. And this sounds so esoteric, but honoring that, that's important. Oh. And sometimes it's a bit of a fight, right? Because like I'm one of those people who have been working full time in a salary job and then do another full time job essentially for writing, right? Mm-hmm. But that takes an effort. That means defending your time, being very conscious about, well, I do want to socialize. I want to hang out with friends. I want to go away for a weekend, but weekends are also when I do my writing. So it's a negotiation. And I think success to me is just not stopping and being mindful of balancing these things and not attributing it with enough importance not to stop. And then, you know, sure, it's great when something gets picked up or sold and it's the best ever if somebody gets in touch and says, hey, I liked your story. But I almost feel like if I were to define success as how much do I sell or how many stories do I have published in some magazine or have I sold a novel, then that might make me unhappy. Mm. So I really want to focus on defining success in terms of what can I control about it. And the thing I can control about it is I can write. I can make the time to write and I can learn how to communicate. Hey, this is my writing time. Maybe we can go on a bike ride another day or something like that. Yeah.
So that's great. I loved, and I wanted to, you sort of answered this a little bit just now, but you said making space for the work and honoring that it's important. And I wanted to ask, is that a struggle and a promise, a struggle with and a promise to yourself, or is it versus, you know, in the most lenient sense of the word, is it versus external forces, external people, life?
Yeah, both a little bit, but it's definitely myself, because I, you know, I didn't grow up, and then by grow up I mean like age 25 and older, calling myself a writer. It's just a sort of an identity that I've only dared to, and I still struggle. Like if somebody asks me, what do you do? And if I were to then respond, I'm a writer, I'm still practicing saying that. And I still have to have people kind of coach me through it and be like, well, do you write? Yes. Do you also publish? Yes. Even though I don't think that's, you know, that's part of the definition of being a writer necessarily. Well, do you get paid to publish? Yes. And so what makes you hesitate? Why would you not say you're a writer? And I'm like, I don't know. I just didn't grow up thinking of myself as a writer. So kind of embracing, defending that identity is sort of new to me, and I'm still growing into it. Yeah. And then there's a certain, a little bit other people. So until quite recently, I was, you know, working full time and then also writing full time after work. So there was always a little bit of like, you know, with my husband and like, let's do something this weekend. I would be kind of grumpy and be like, I don't want to because I want to write. So a little bit, but I think not as strong as some other, for like the external forces are not as strong for me as for some other people.
Well, that's good. And so, I mean, first of all, and I know you've heard this already, but yeah, not only are you a writer, but you're an author. Because
how do you, what's the difference for you? Like, I am always curious, like, what's the difference?
Well, you've published and you've been paid for your work.
Paid to publish, yeah.
You are a professional author.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I am. I'm like a member of professional bodies and everything.
Yes.
Still, so, you know, maybe it's, this is, oh, now it's almost like, now it's almost like therapy. So now, maybe it is because writing has been, is mm-hmm. such a playground. It feels playful that I'm kind of incredulous that I'm getting paid to do it. And I was like, what? I'm just playing.
I mean, this is all kind of a form of imposter syndrome, right? And so I heard there's a popular podcaster, and he's one of the, his podcast is not about writing at all. It's all about internet marketing. The tagline for his show, it's Pat Flynn. And the tagline for his show is, you know, working hard now so you can sit back and enjoy the fruits of your blah, 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 blah. So mm-hmm. he's a big passive income guy, but his, I think I first heard it on his show. And he was talking about, you know, interviewing other marketers and passive income people. And he was talking about the responsibility to put your work out there, because you are providing something that no one else can do.
This is great, because this is something that's been on my mind recently as well. It's like this whole, you know, I've always worked other jobs, mm-hmm. like it was, you know, in language instruction, and I was most recently, I was in tech, a computational linguist for mm-hmm. a tech company. And I always kind of, in these jobs, I was never really fully there. Mm-hmm. I always hid a little something. And even if it was writing, you know, it wasn't widely known mm-hmm. to my coworkers at any given job that I went home and then put in another full day, essentially, of writing. It's not widely known, but recently more and more I felt like there's a certain, like, almost like an obligation. It sounds weird, but kind of like you just said, like, I have to share this. I should share this because it's something, it doesn't feel unique to me because I'm in such a writerly network and everyone around me has a novel written pretty much, you know, but it's in the greater world. It's something that I ought to share more, I think.
Well, absolutely. And just the actual work itself. I mean, how do I call myself a writer? Having a difficult time calling yourself a writer. Well, I mean, again, that's what you are giving to the world. And it's kind of an affirmational arrogance, right?
that's really it. I've been thinking about that so much lately, especially like this whole, the affirmation part of it, like, you know, it's sort of like this chicken or egg. Like
there's definitely a sort of motivational delusion that you have to have in place. So, absolutely.
Yes. And what's really talked to me or spoken to me lately was this whole, like, identity forward, living or thinking of your career. Like it's something, where was this? Oh, it was in this book, which of course I forget the title. 1% Change. Anyway, it's a book. Maybe mm-hmm. we can edit this later. I don't know. Where it's about habit forming. And so it's like, if you think of yourself as a writer, like, identity first, sort of say, mm-hmm. so you're like, I'm a writer. And then for any decision along the way, you can ask yourself, what would a writer do in this situation? Mm-hmm. Would a writer accept this invitation to appear on a panel at a conference? Yes, they would. You know, they wouldn't be too shy. They would be like, yes, I'm a writer. I will. Yes. That's what a writer does. And would a writer sit down every day to write? Yes, because that is what a writer does. And asking myself this question a lot is like, what would a writer do? Would they say they're a writer? Probably. that's sort of been on my mind lately, and I've been working on using that question as sort of a guide to what do I do? Where do I go next? What do I submit? What do I write?
That's great. It's your lodestone. Yeah. which now this is a not so difficult, not so clumsy segue, because it does get into the third idea of staying healthy and sane in whatever that means to each of us in the process of creating this creative writing life, whatever that means. And, you know, naturally we've touched on some things, but what are some of the other sort of deliberate things that you've discovered along the way that help you in that regard?
Oh man, I'm so glad you asked that question, because I've sort of been practicing talking about this more. Like, I had a really interesting journey in last year, 2022, and I kind of mentioned that I thought of myself as a fundamentally anxious person. So much, I feel like, when I look back of my life, has been driven by a sense of anxiety and a sense of I need to be in control. So I'm what's called an adult child of an alcoholic, which is a term I learned in therapy. I didn't know that was a thing. But once I learned that, I was like, oh yeah, this applies to me. Like, type A, a people pleaser, not a troublemaker, you know, these kinds of things. And I've been
quicksand. Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah. Like, coming from this really kind of unstable, erratic environment. And early in 2022, I had this moment where it's like, I was just a puddle of anxiety. It was fogging up my brain. And I made the decision to finally, you know, I knew I had some difficult stuff in like my childhood and growing up and stuff like that. So it's like, I'm going to make a decision. I'm making the decision to finally talk to someone about it, to find a therapist, which was really paradoxical, because I was so anxious that even just calling therapists was really hard.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I called like four or five and they were all fully booked. And there was one that really wasn't a good match. And I knew, like, and I guess writing also helped with this, because this thinking so much, and like rationally, irrationally, and also writing characters who had maybe issues with anxiety, I knew I had better days and worse days. Mm-hmm. So I knew, okay, I'm just going to wait for a better day and I'm going to do this. And then also quieting the voice that said, oh, it's not even that bad. Oh, you're taking away a spot for someone else who needs it more.
Oh man.
Also that as well. So it was a big step for me to even do that. But even like two sessions in, I found a wonderful therapist, and two sessions in, it was just like, I had these really useful techniques right off the bat that I could use that were really applicable to me, to dial down the anxiety when it was there. And I'm so glad I did that. I'm so glad I started therapy, because I realized how much anxiety had been driving me. And it feels like I freed up my headspace to create more. And like, maybe some people will say, oh, but you know, you can write about all your difficult experiences. Yes, I can, but I don't need to feel shitty while I'm doing it.
That's right.
Like, I have plenty of memories of shitty times that I can draw on in my horror, you know, or to use as character background, but I don't need to be feeling in a brain fog of anxiety while I'm doing it. So such a significant journey to me, and it helped me kind of maintain a mentally healthy balance between, you know, as I said, working full time, writing full time. It's just been amazing.
And so, are these, you mentioned techniques, and you know, to share, I had my first of only three, thankfully, so far, knock wood, anxiety attacks in 2015. And it was it was as a result of a big sort of just a very bad, awful, horrible set of circumstances and time pressure and whatnot. Not like a lifelong kind of thing. Although, you know, of course I was predisposed without knowing it. But right away I learned, you know, certain things that I'd kind of only known in passing, like deliberate breathing techniques and some people use tapping and you know, things. So if you want to share, what were some of the things that you, because these will, I guarantee you this is going to help someone who is listening.
I really hope, like, even just like this whole thought of, oh, it's not that bad. Oh, I don't need therapy. It's just like, it was amazing to do it. And I do realize it's hard, but yeah, I mean, the techniques, what I really appreciate about like meeting with a person, an actual therapist in a room. Mm-hmm. I started out seeing her once a week. And then these days I'm only like seeing her every 4 weeks or so because I'm just so much better.
You
and
it's tools. So fun. To, yeah.
Yes. It's so fun to be so much better. What I appreciated about just a little preamble that these techniques really, these aren't like, these are really catered to me and what worked for me, which is the great part about like meeting with a therapist rather than just like going to like reading an article on a blog, which is a good step for sure. But this one, these techniques are really catered sort of to my specific sort of issues and anxiety. So one thing I found really helpful was I'm a writer, so she knows that. She makes me write these like, we call it brain dumps. So a lot of my anxiety is sort of future facing anxiety, and I'm kind of like spiraling about, maybe, for example, let's take travel. I love traveling, but I used to get so anxious. I couldn't think about anything else before. Mm-hmm. And she suggested I write a brain dump and write down every single thing I can think of that made me anxious about traveling. And I started doing that and was like getting the middle seat and having to wake someone to the bathroom and the airplane and getting a migraine somewhere, or like having some health issues somewhere, or, you know, getting my period somewhere. All of these what ifs, exactly, which we're so good at as writers, like what if? And so the technique is to write down everything until you can't think of anything anymore, until you start repeating yourself. And then like, that's it. And then you go back and look at themes, like, what are just general themes? And some themes for me were always like health related. Like, I get these migraines and the aura is really difficult because, the time before you go into the migraine headache, for me, sometimes it comes with like not being able to speak, which is really scary. Mm. So I'm always terrified of, you know, that happening somewhere in public where I can't, you know, sit somewhere quietly for an hour and stuff like that. So health issues, people pleasing is a huge thing for me. Like, this whole thing, like, oh no, I may have to disturb the person on the airplane next to me to go to the bathroom. Oh no, you know, things like that. Right. So write that down. I then kind of circle the big topics, other people, health issues, for example. Mm-hmm. And then the last step in that exercise, the brain dump exercise, is to think about, okay, what can I do to give myself a sense of control back if that situation happens? And so some examples for me would have been to have my migraine medicine with me, of course. I also have a little like electronic post-it note on my phone that says, hi, I'm having a medical situation. Is there somewhere quiet I can go? Things like that. Just little things I can do to give myself a sense of control back. Mm-hmm. That means just like, you know, planning ahead and checking into the flight early, making sure I get an aisle seat, considering if maybe I have the funding to buy myself a seat that's, you know, better for me and on the airplane, stuff like that. And that's really helped. So that was one thing. And then another thing that's also very writerly actually is a different technique. So you're catastrophizing about a scenario, right? Mm-hmm. What if I am taking care of my niece and she falls into a river? Something like that. You know, right. I was up at night stressing out about potentially catastrophic scenarios. Mm-hmm. And then the technique is to keep asking yourself, suppose that happens, what then?
Which sounds on the surface like it would only make it worse, but I see where you're going.
Yes, but you go there and eventually, and then what then? So you're playing, like I'm playing with my niece and there's a river and she falls in, what then? I would jump after her. What then? Well, I would grab her. What then? I would drag her out. What then? I would take her home and get her dry. Mm-hmm. You know, things like that. And of course, there's some scenarios where you can really, really reach the worst case ever. And then if you do reach the worst case ever, my therapist always says, what's the likelihood happening?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then the answer is usually like, so slim.
Yeah. Ridiculously
and
small.
Why? Yeah. Yeah. And why are they so slim? Well, because I am a diligent person and I have been taught by anxiety to be sort of, you know, maybe careful, and this likelihood is, the realistic likelihood of this happening is absolutely slim, tiny. And that helps. And that, you know, it's not about making the anxiety go away altogether, but just dialing it down to a level that allows you to focus on other things. And that's the biggest takeaway I've had, from going to therapy. It's just this whole, like, I am now able, I'm not at its mercy anymore, right? I can dial it down so that I can then have a productive writing day.
I see so many correlations, not just talking to you, but with other writers mm-hmm. and authors, that in one way or another, the ideas of both releasing control and mm-hmm. recognizing what's under our control come up again and again in different ways, mm-hmm. in different contexts. And you said it yourself earlier, you know, if you focused on selling and feedback, you would probably be unhappy. Not as important as, you know, what can I control? I can control sitting down and writing every day.
Yeah.
I can control having a schedule that allows for that. I can, you know.
Yes.
And that's stoicism, right? Don't give a shit about the stuff that you have no control over.
Yeah.
And you've
give a little.
Well,
give
yeah.
a little shit. Give a little
well,
bit.
Well, you've extended it by also saying, you know, recognize the likelihood of those things that you have no control over.
Yes.
Actually occurring, actually having an impact on your life and your everyday, you know. Don't worry about the niece falling in the river while you guys are walking down the street.
exactly. And so the moment anxiety and worrying and catastrophizing became a problem for me was that I would be walking down the street, but I wouldn't even notice that I was walking down the street very happily in a beautiful environment mm-hmm. because I was completely focused on this irrational, well, not entirely irrational, but this really, really, really unlikely,
catastrophic
outcome in the future. Mm-hmm. And it's been an amazing journey to just, it's difficult at times, but so worthwhile to just really unravel where that comes from.
Yeah.
And it's a sort of a cliche, but like you go back to childhood trauma a lot of the time, or formative time. And I'm so glad that I also identify that I had writing at my disposal as a coping mechanism during that time. Because another thing that I've sort of learned to acknowledge is if you're a child going through like a difficult situation, you can't be expected to know how to cope with it.
Right.
So there's lots of like learning self-forgiveness in a way, like mm-hmm. forgiving yourself, your child self. And I'm just so glad I had writing during all that time, because I could have found something else. You know, I could have found another way of escaping. And with addiction definitely running in my family,
that's right.
I could have found a substance, mm-hmm. but I found writing. And I think it's a pretty, as coping mechanisms go, it's pretty healthy.
Absolutely. So the kind of corny closing question that I have been asking, if you could sort of consolidate and summarize everything that to this point that you've learned and discovered and put into practice about your creative writing life, if you could bring it all down to maybe a maxim or a bumper sticker slogan, something, you know, something so fundamental, what would that be?
Oh, you're ready for maximum corniness. I'll deliver. Excellent. I think my bumper sticker slogan would be something like follow what sparks joy. Because I've tried writing in genres or stories where I thought, ooh, this is kind of hip right now. I may be able to sell this. But there was no joy for me in it. Mm. And if, you know, if follow what sparks joy creatively, if I direct my energy toward the thing that gives me joy, I feel like I'm usually rewarded in some way. And so if I really love something like a genre or a setting, I'll just write in that setting until I find another thing that sparks more joy. That's it.
The thing about that is that you can unfold and expand that, and it applies to everything else that you've been saying.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
The idea of, because everything that you've said, like honoring your time and refining your process to the point where, you know, both the play and the analytical side is probably, I'm sure, never perfectly, but kind of integrated, you know, recognizing and doing something about the anxiety and doing the difficult work to dig into your past and self-realization and all of that stuff, that all fuels the ability. Those are all paving stones that you can use to follow that thing that makes you happy, that brings you joy. That's fantastic. is there anything that we've sort of maybe speaking of paving stones that we've sort of, you know, they've skipped across the river, not the dangerous river with your niece, but the happy conversational river.
Happy conversational.
Anything that we've kind of touched on and maybe you wanted to reiterate on or expand upon or bring back that we haven't covered enough?
Not really. I just had this thought of like, I'm here like promoting joy, like spark joy. And then I'm like, I'm a horror writer, but I just thought that was kind of funny, but I derive joy from horror and being scared in a safe environment. And I love thinking about what might scare other people. So that brings me joy. Like it brings me joy to analyze what is the most scary situation I could describe right now? How could I make this atmosphere really creepy? That's joyful too.
I think it is. I think it is. Yeah. And it gets back into that self-discovery thing. I wrote an article a few years back, a writing exercise. And it was, you know, the idea was for writing better bad guys, you know. But it applies really to all of this. And my premise in a nutshell was sit down and think of the absolute worst possible thing that another human being could do to another human being.
Ooh.
Okay, now get worse. Think about, get something worse, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, disgust yourself with what you can think of. Now, write down, you know, you get this. Write down what it would take you to do that thing.
Oh, wow. I'm going to do that. That's going to be instructive.
I'll send you the link to the full post.
Yeah.
Because the idea is get your hands dirty. No, you know, actually get up to the neck, get up to the nostrils in awfulness. and it's going to teach you empathy. It's going to it's going to, you know, because if you understand what it's what it would take for you to do that. And
yeah,
and you're not a horrible person, we assume, right? Then
we hope.
We hope. Then you're going to understand your character better. And it doesn't mean that every bad guy in a story has to be some redeemable, tragic figure. It just means that you can understand them. And when you talked about, you know, thinking about the scariest things that, you know, for other people, that's exactly, it's the same thing. It's you're tapping into that empathy, that old cliche that specificity is universal, you know? It's wonderful.
Nice.
Well, this has been fantastic. As always, every time I've yet to be disappointed. It's a conversation that has, you've brought a unique perspective. You've provided a different point of view, and there's so much that folks are going to be able to take away from this as writers at any level, I'm sure. And I thank you so much for being on Sonatotum.
Thank you so much for having me.
There it is, friends. My conversation with author Anna Ziegelhoff. Remember, you can find Anna at annaziegelhoff.com, AnnaZiegelhoff.com, and on Instagram as Anna with a Z. That's all one word, Anna with a Z, and two N's in Anna, of course. That was a fine conversation. I had a lot of fun talking to Anna, and it was the last conversation that I had recorded this year so far. And so I thought it would be a good time to also give a little rest to Sonatotum. You know, I've been talking in some previous episodes and elsewhere, speaking to my multiversalist patrons about how much time the podcast takes and how limited my time has been, especially in this year, 2023. So I've decided to move Sonatotum to a seasonal schedule. Instead of just doing an episode every 2 weeks all year round, we're going to do seasons. And by we, I mean me. I'm the only one over here in the lush and lavish studios of MWS Media in sunny Southern California. Sunny now, it was kind of overcast not even 20 minutes ago, and I am actually, here we are on October 11th, 2023, and I am sweating in my office here in the lush and lavish studios of MWS Media. Maybe it's because I'm a little nervous about talking to you about this change of schedule, change of publication frequency for Sonatotum. Yeah, so the new season of Sonatotum will begin in March of 2024. Specifically, Wednesday, March 20th, 2024 will be the official start of the new season, the official start of a shift to a seasonal schedule. And I will still be doing interviews primarily with creative folks, mostly writers, authors at all stages of their development, joining me in what I hope are evergreen and valuable conversations on making stuff, finding success as we each define it, and staying healthy and sane in the process. So between now and then, I am absolutely open to recording interviews. So if you are an author, writer, poet, playwright, anything involved in the creative writing life, if you make narrative stories, and you know what? That includes songwriting as well. If you work in the narrative prose form, I want to talk to you. I don't care where you're at in your journey. As long as you're willing to talk openly and with some measure of vulnerability and honesty about making your thing, finding success as you define it, and staying healthy and sane in the process, I want to talk to you on Sonatotum. To find out more about how you can schedule a conversation, visit my site, mattselznick.com/sonatotum-guest-inquiry. That's mattselznick.com, mattselznick.com/sonatotum-guest-inquiry. And of course, Sonatotum is spelled Sonitotum. Or of course, you can just go to mattselznick.com. If you hover over the podcast menu item, you'll see the submenu for guest inquiries. Between then and now, I won't say there won't be any Sonatotum episodes, because hey, if I want to reach out and talk to you in this medium, then I will. So by all means, stay subscribed. If you are subscribed, of course, it's free. It's a free podcast. Stay subscribed, and you might just see some episodes pop up in your feed between now and March when the mood strikes me. If you haven't subscribed to Sonatotum, know that you can do that pretty much anywhere you get your podcasts, or you can find the RSS feed for the podcast that you can copy paste into any podcast app or client over there at mattselznick.com. Just click on the podcast menu item and you will see it there on that page. But really, you can find Sonatotum anywhere you get your podcasts. Also, of course, if you'd like to become part of the mailing list community, then I will let you know just as soon as there's stuff to let you know about. You can do that at mattselznick.com/join-the-community. And I don't send out too many emails, but when there's something to talk to you about, well, I like to talk to you about that. So that's what's going on, folks. I need to be smarter about how I do this show. I think this show has value to folks. I know that it has value to my multiversalist patrons. And let's take a moment to thank those folks, by the way. Let's thank Chuck Anderson and Amy Bowen and J.C. Hutchins and Ted Leonhardt and Jim Lewinson and Pearl Zare for being patrons for just $5 a month. You can join them. You can support not just this show, even in its little hiatus, because after all, I will be working behind the scenes, recording those interviews and perhaps other solo episodes, but also my other creative endeavors. And I'm going to get to that in just a second. If you'd like to become a multiversalist patron, the best way to do that and to find out more is to visit, you guessed it, mattselznick.com/b-a-patron. You can find out the latest on what I plan to offer and what I do offer my multiversalist patrons. And oh, by the way, at least for the foreseeable future, there is a 7-day free trial. So you'll get all the benefits for the first 7 days. And, you know, hey, if you decide that you don't want to support my creative endeavors and the effort that goes into creating this podcast, the effort that's already gone into creating the last 95 episodes, then you can unsubscribe before those 7 days are up. Otherwise, it's just $5 a month to be a multiversalist patron. So what's coming next? What's coming between now and March 20th, 2024? Well, I know this much, folks. I am going to be doing more writing, more prose work. I'm going to be shifting the time that I spend on this podcast, which is, anywhere from 12 to to 15 hours across the course of 14 days, I'm going to be spending at least that much time refocusing on my prose, on my writing. Not just my long delayed next novel, Shadow of the Outsider, and not just the long overdue future installments of the free serial fiction offering that I provide my mailing list subscribers, Hazy Days and Cloudy Nights, but also a newsletter and blog posts and maybe even another serial. I've got a lot of words that I want to write, and I want to put that effort into that because, honestly, on the one hand, I think that I can reach more people with my words than I have been with this podcast for the same amount of effort. But also, I have to remember one of my goals, one of the ways that I measure success. I've mentioned it in the podcast before. It's a silly little mantra of mine, a silly little aspiration. I want to earn a comfortable living solely from the fruits of my creative endeavors. And one of those is writing. But I haven't been doing a whole lot of writing, folks. I haven't really, with any kind of dedication or focused intent, done any fiction writing since April of this year. And one reason for that, not the only reason by any means, but one big reason for that has been the effort that I've been putting into this podcast. So we're going to flip it for a little while. And we're going to get some interviews recorded and in the can, as they say. And the podcast in earnest will be back on March 20th, 2024. Except for some bonus episodes as the mood strikes me between then and now. But that doesn't mean I'm not going to be creating. It doesn't mean I'm not going to be providing value and content for my Multiversalist patrons and for, I hope, a whole bunch of new folks who join my community of friends and fans, my reader community. I want to give that reader community some new things to read. So that's what's up. This Sonatotum episode, Sonatotum 95, is the end of a 95 episode season one. And granted, there were some big breaks in that run, but we will officially move to a seasonal release schedule beginning on March 20th, 2024. I really do hope you stick around. It doesn't cost you anything to keep Sonatotum in your list of podcasts that you subscribe to. It doesn't cost you anything at all to be part of the reader community by joining the mailing list at mattselznick.com/join-the-community. So just hang around. And when you hear from me, that'll be a little surprise. But you are going to hear from me. There's stuff happening. All right. I'm very grateful to all of you, dear listeners, beloved multiversalists. But I'm also kind of relieved and excited, and I feel a definite release of pressure, a big exhale at what's to come in the next 4 or 5 months and beyond. Stick around. My name is Matthew Wayne Selznick. Take care.